So why don't you start out with just where you grew up and how you got started longshoring and how you came to Tacoma.
All right. And while I'm giving that thought now, what you said there, and I got a couple of notes I want to write that I thought of on the way down here. If you will, type out this one. And while I'm getting my head together, and naturally you're going to have to brief a lot of things I do. Let's have a look at it. Can you go for that? Type this one out. That's about the Christian part.
Well,
by miracle healing.
Could I keep this and just make a copy of it? Because I think it would take 15 or 20 minutes to type it up and then...
Well, I hadn't thought about this for over a week. It's I really need a little time. Of course, I'll remember as we go through it, though.
Mm-hmm.
In my whole career as a longshoreman, is this Port of Tacoma, this great industrial thing that we've built here, and so how much of that do you want to stress? To me, it's the greatest thing. It has even pulled up other labor, like take for example right today. The auto workers, I read it, I heard it over TV. That one guy on TV is saying, this has been a practice for a long time, never buy a car on Monday or Friday. Of course, they can't tell that. They says, on Monday they're not in good shape to work, and on Friday they're already planning their vacations. Mm-hmm. And see, they were knocked down, and some of it was true, because cars didn't stand up. There's so many things wrong with American guys. Look, they still pull them in yet today. Mm-hmm. And some of that's the fault of the workmen. And then at the same time, the Japanese on the ships were the best sailors I've ever known. I worked the ships all through all those years. You see, 35 steady years, longshoremen. They were the best sailors in the world. And so Japan making cars makes a good car. My brother runs one. I tried telling him he should buy an American car. And he said, no, I'm going to get one that I really like and I know is going to be good. You got one of those better Japanese cars. And so, we can start out. I was, as a little kid, at 5 years old, they always ask you in those days when people visit, what are you going to do when you grow up? It was just as standard as, you know, as your mother telling you to wash your face before you eat, you wash your hands and face. So I said, well, I want to be a big league ball player. But I says, I realized even at the age of five when I first remember telling them about this, I says, but I realized I might not make that. But one thing I am going to do, I'm going to go out to Seattle and I'm going to ride those big boats to Alaska. And so you see, I was sort of born with this, a love. I really mean it. And when I got to Seattle at the age of 14 for the first time, by the way, I never did ride a boat to Alaska, but I went by airplane to serve the men many times, several times. And so I got to Seattle at the age of 14, and my brother Tony was 3 years younger than I. We came together. Dad had gone to Port Angeles, and boy, the guy in the restaurant says, why don't you go down to the docks? And he was hunting a job, seeing. And he says, why don't you go down to the docks? They hire these guys extra, and they pay them twice what the mill men make. My dad got $7.20 when he left a job in the mill for $3.40. He worked at time in there. And he got $3.40, and he went to $7.20 immediately on the docks. All right, so he says, my dad met us at the dock because they came in, and he was already longshoring, and he said, I bet I know where where Tony was last night, 6 hours down, 12 till 6 on in those days with that Solduck, the old Solduck. He was old. He says, Tony slept inside and never came out once. And he says, you spent your entire night at the bow. I says, that's right. I was watching the porpoises and the ducks and everything, and it was a beautiful night coming down. It was smooth, and it's hardly ever that smooth, you know, out there. And then when I got to the point, I saw all these boats out there. And I was really interested in that, all these guys out there rowing around. So when I got into the dock, Dad says, I know where you spent the night. And I said, yeah, right up there on the bow. And I said, what are all those guys doing out there in those boats? He says, they're fishing. I said, what are they fishing for? He says, salmon. I said, salmon? Get me a boat. Just like that. I'd been up all night, but I wanted a boat. So he says, well, you got to go home now, and you got to rest. But I promise you, I'll bring you back down here tomorrow morning and get you a boat so you can go out. And the old guy at the dock, I was 14 and strong. I was a wiry kid. I loved to run. I just run because I wanted to. And I was in the hills all the time. I didn't play with my sisters. I had two sisters a little older than I, and I never knew anything about making mud pies or anything. And I finally asked a sister, I says, I can't remember playing with you and Mamie. She says, simple, you didn't. She says, you're always gone in the hills somewhere. And I had an old horse that I could lay down sleep with and all of that. And I wasn't afraid of rattlesnakes. Mother had warned me every day before it took off. Rattlesnake, coyote, the whole thing. See, I was born of the wilderness is in my makeup. That's why I got along fine with the Alaska guys. I had this primitive in me, and I knew how to deal with them and could talk to them. And they trusted me where the many district secretaries they would not trust. They trusted me more than anyone. And so then I went down to this guy, and he says, he says, I got a boat. And we put a boat out the edge of the water and got the oars and everything fixed. He did. Told me, I never fished salmon though, you know. So he told me how to tie the line on and everything. And he says, I'll show you the length. And he says, did you ever row a boat? I says, no, but by the time I get the end of that cannery dock, I'll be rowing. And so, to make it quick, they warned me, going across the bay, I rowed my brother all the way over, all the time we're fishing, all the way back. I didn't want him to have those oars. He wasn't strong enough. We had to do something, you know. And I could stand on my rowers, three miles across there. I'm trying to talk fast. And so, we caught 5 salmon that day, and one great big lincod had a hold of one of my small salmon, and I got him in the boat. And he cut his head off and gutted him out. He still weighed 34 pounds. Ooh. And the guy said, the market even told me, he says, he took a liking to me too. And he said, don't gut them and cut their heads off. He says, it goes round measure. That guy that let me have the boat, he says, say, I like the spirit of this kid. Dad says, he'll be back. You can better believe it. And this guy says, wait. He brought me down his own spoon. He went up to his cabin and got me his own spoon. I make him, he says. And this is one of my favorites. You will catch fish. But he says, I want to tie it to the boat at the lake. He says, well, you're going over. I was out there so early, I was going to be over there before daybreak. See, I rowed over in the dark first darn time. See, I wasn't afraid of the dark no more than daylight. And so I caught all those fish. Then finally he tells me, quit renting boats. Buy your own. And I'll take care of it. And then he guided me to an Indian dugout that was as good as was ever made. And I fished then on the outside. I'd go out there to look like a dollhouse at the lighthouse there. Mm-hmm. And it was crazy. And my mother says, you're going to be the death of me yet. And I'd watch those smokestacks. I'd go on certain days. Just one time if a smoke blade over, I don't care if I had a fish on, I would tear him off. And lay down on those oars and come on in. I rigged them out about this extra far so that I would, and this long, and bolted these on the keel. Then I got my locks on the outside of those, and I got myself a big, long, heavy oaken oars. And you wouldn't know by looking at me now. I once was strong. I could, in football, I just picked up the big tackles. I only weighed 160 pounds playing town team ball around the country. But I was strong enough in the legs and everything. I hit a guy low and come up with him, but it's all, lifting is a lot of art, of course.
Sure.
I'm not talking about deadweight. And I could get a big tackle on my back and pack him, throw him down the backfield every now and then. I tried to do it regularly. So that was my start. Now I'm packing my dad's lunch. And I go back inside the way back where it's dark and put your line through a hole, lots of holes in the dock.
Sure.
The guys fell through and hurt their legs and everything. And we never cured that till here. Mm-hmm. And I could catch these bass just as fast as I get a minnow down. I learned to make a rake that was one of the best. I put needles on them. I'd get minnows when other guys couldn't get them. Always studying. Started making my own spoons because that guy guided me into that. I made some dandy spoons. I caught lots of fish with them. And so that's where I'd pack his lunch at noon, then I'd fish till he got off ship. And I sometimes had a pile of bass. And the longshoremen would come off. Sometimes they didn't have any money and all that. I said, it's all right, take what you want. They'd yell at me across the street of town and bring me some money. They say, I owe you a dollar. I says, you really do? Guy be really drunk, see, maybe. I said, you really do? He said, yeah. So you see, they took me in when they didn't want anybody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't want anybody. They became, my dad helped the organization get started. He was number one man in the organization field there. And he believed in the unity of labor, taught me all these things about labor. So I came by it through a dad and through the national love of the docks. And so my other brothers, three other brothers, decided not to go to the docks. And one finally came back. But I stayed pretty much right with the docks. I worked for a while on the Bell Telephone Company, going out to Forks. It was a very interesting job. It was wild nature along the lakes and everything. Treated us great, and then I returned to the docks to stay. And I made a steady gang by the time 1928. Then they organized, didn't organize till late in there. In Tacoma here, yes, in the 1900s something. You've already got that history and tiny in my life. But we organized there in about 35. So by 37, they took me in when they didn't want anybody, and called me high school punk when I had two kids of my own. They still were calling me the high school punk. And so then later, of course, the young men, they had to, you know, the guy, older guys dying off. They took in younger men, but I was the first. There was one other, Carlton B, came on just about the same time I did. And over in this town, Vic Olson was young like I was. And his dad, the same as mine, was a longshoreman. And we proved we could do the work, and we got in. So there I became secretary, dispatcher, business agent, negotiator, janitor. In 37, I had it all. And they had enough faith through my dad and then me, listen to you talking to Waterford, and they know you, there's only about 135 men there. Mm-hmm. And they sent me out to negotiate. I says, always two, no less than two. They says, no, Floyd. They stood up one day and clapped and says, go ahead, just don't come back until you get what we're after. That's all there is to it. And so there's a long story about that. The employer, when I finally went back visiting, he invited me in. He knew what kind of whiskey I drank. He knew all about me. He said, I'd like to have given you my boat and my cabin. I didn't dare play up to you because he says, Floyd, you'd had my job in the office and the whole thing. He says, the way you drive. And the employer in Seattle knew me as relentless. And so I get a broken home there, and I leave for here. In about 41. By the way, I saw the old men. When mill jobs were 340, these guys were, and they were getting 720, however, but they put a dollar in a snooze box. I watched the big boss, big fin boss, 6'5", way over 200 pounds, and about this wide. Man, he had shoulders. And I watched him walk four different hatches, right, like this, just right on down, and take a chew of snooze, presumably. He's pulling a dollar out, silver dollar then. So I fished off the end of the spit with another friend whose dad lived down there. And I got to know these guys personally. And I says, why do you do it? He says, well, Floyd, we have to. I said, we can't hold our job. Now, mind you, the same thing was still going on the East Coast. I learned to abhor it there. I abhorred it on the East Coast guys.
Now, this was in Tacoma, this thing with the
snooze
box?
No, this dollar and snooze box was in Port Angeles.
Okay.
Tacoma had organized till they'd get done away with this. They had a hiring system.
That's what I thought. So
I became the dispatcher, and the moment I did, I put the earnings behind a cage. There was two things going on. They had the drink and smell gang, mm-hmm. and these guys catered to the boss, And this same lad I was talking about that I fished with, he was a little younger than I, he smoked his fish up to his big brother's, who was a boss. So he says, come on, we go up and smoke, and Jim will make you a deal, he'll take so many fish. And then finally, this kid's dad said to me, why don't you join the gang, the inside gang? I says, nobody's ever asked me. Ah, he says, take 10 fish up, leave 10. Says, do that every little while. And he says, Jim keeps a record, and if you just don't come back, he sells that to the ships. He's down here, you see him, the fish coming on these ships. I says, sure I do. Well, he says, that's how, you know. And he said, I saw us these guys pack in wine and flowers and candy and ham and, you know, and venison and elk meat. And I hated this kind of thing. First off, I was a Christian kid when I was young. And by the time I was 16, I just left the church to go fishing and didn't like the dogma and the formality. Said, no, I wouldn't go back to a church like that by any means. I'm a Christian, practicing Christian. But it's the gospel. It's all I'm interested in, the gospel of Jesus, and live by that word. So now, I come up here, I begin to travel for those guys with an older man first, then on my own. And I came up here, and I'd been in on their conventions and all that, and I was their handyman when I wasn't even elected, you see, if they wanted anything uptown or some printing done or anything they wanted, you know. Floyd scoot out and get it all done for him. So I knew every guy that was negotiating from these different ports that rivers, and that Tacoma was the head of. Mm-hmm. Tiny Trunson had his office in the Perkins building. Mm-hmm. Now I come up here and I start visiting Tiny. That's where I met the wife that I love so dearly. And she finally died of cancer, helped breaking up my health, along with other things. And so now I was going up to see Tiny and all this, and I worked a permit. And they gave me another 30 days when the 30 days was all they're going to give you. And they says, oh, well, we're not pressed for visitors here, so let's take Floyd again. And the executive board passed it and all. And then the business agent himself said to me, Floyd, if you go down to the warehouse, I'll dispatch you to the warehouse. You stay there a while, because they won't, that one job calls you back every weekend, as long as you're called back. So I went trucking for Milwaukee pulp. And I think it was pulp all the time. And the old boys liked that because I was an expert trucker already. And they tire, but they're strong. They're really strong. These are the old boys. They were powerful, but they got to where they couldn't walk so well. Walking was, you know, and I told you my background, easy for me. I even won a mile race in high school. That's the kind of condition I stayed in. So then now they accept me here in 41. I was first a visitor for several months, and then they took me in. And they said, we don't want anybody, but they said, we don't want to let Floyd. And I had in mind, I'd stop off here, visit a while. I fell in love with that lady. And then I got up on Stadium Way, and she lived in an apartment up near there. And I went out on the point there by the stadium and up on top. And I looked over this thing, and here's another gift that God has given me, this geodetic kind of thing. I was told that when I was in high school. It was one of my natural gifts. A guy that would read the lines, you know, and all this. He said, geodetic survey is a gift of yours, and you better look into the engineering. I also had an engineering job offered me if I could go on to school. But I didn't make it, because I could cut a straight line through the brush and would hardly miss. Just a few feet, you know, a lot of times. Uh-huh. And when I couldn't see, I'd go a quarter mile. And maybe missed 10, 20 feet. And the guy says, I was amazing. And so then he learned to like me, and I had the condition to keep going, whacking away, you know, and get him up there quicker. So he said, my dad's got to retire. I'll make an engineer of him. I wanted to, but I couldn't. That's outside work. I'd love that. But I couldn't get the schooling, so high school's all I got. Now I'm here. And fell in love with this gal, and I was standing up on that point up there, and I was gripped, absolutely gripped, with what I saw out here. And I could see the tide flats and the ducks, and I knew what they were because my brother-in-law hunted down there. And I said, well, I'm going to make some people unhappy one day, but we're going to make a port out of that. I knew then. I says, I'll dedicate myself to that, to stay here and marry this gal and start leading off on building this port. And so by no later than 44, I had convinced some of the men to go with me to meet the city dads. And I'm sure the first one was Val Fawcett, that far back, mayor. And then a little later, John Anderson. And they each had a Marine committee of some kind. And I would take our guys to them, and then later on I joined all of these committees, you know. When, so they took me in, and I was had ideas about conditions and everything, you know. So I didn't want to take any leadership. I didn't want to crowd ahead of anybody. I never took a winch driving job or a boss job or a crane job ahead of somebody that was already skilled in there if they would do their work. I just made it a principle. So I became a, in this meantime, you know, I'm becoming a winch driver when they were short. And then I was in the hall, when I got tired of the heavy work, I'd come down to the hall, cleaned up. I only lived up the road to the YMCA I was staying at the time. So he says, Floyd, would you, we got nobody, would you go down there and take this winch job? These guys are old, seeing they're getting sick and they're getting too weak to get on the job. They were 55 years old, age average, when I came to town. And so this started me thinking about the industrial area, about their welfare. See them always in my mind, reaching out. Pete Peterson, that was in the Central Labor Council, that became head man, he says, Floyd, your biggest problem is you're out there 15 years ahead of us most of the time. He says, that's where you get into problems, trying to, and you get frustrated sometimes, I know, you must, because you can't get us to see it. He says, you're to your head. And so I saw this, that's the kind of mind I had, I see this ahead. And so I began to lay out in my mind how the waterways should go, where the warehouses should go, and how many feet back from the waterways. And then, and no more bridges. I was asked, and I don't think I can prove this, I think they're all three dead. McElvay was head of the Central at that time. This is, I don't know when the bridges built, in the late 40s?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Early 50s, I would say. So anyhow, I said, no, I won't go ahead of McElvay, Bernie Reed, or Moisio. When I came here, these men I looked up to, and they've taught me a lot, and I think they're the leaders of the county. And I'll not go ahead of them. He says, but it's your program. And you have said, told us many times, that this must be the last bridge. This one's needed because of this one road's already here and the bridge is down there. And I couldn't see them wiping those out, which they should have done right from the start. But, and probably maybe done yet. But I don't think so. So this one road, I could see that that was going to stay. And so I fight it. So the new bridge is necessary to let the ships in when we start pumping sand. And so I said this would be the last bridge though. We got to put other waterways. Then I wanted the main road, this side the freeway, to go into the town fast, come out of these and go right on into town to save the town, to save the city. They had plans for it finally, but that never materialized. But at least they made the roads out and come with these finger roads in. Mm-hmm. Now, one of my next big projects was, well, they start pumping sand, of course, and they're making these waterways. And the way that I had lined them out, now Maury Raymond comes on the scene, and I want him mentioned. And he gets elected in 52, and the longshoremen went behind him and the Central Labor Council. I went down to Maury Raymond. I never saw him before, but he had the right, they said he was a stubborn guy that was relentless, and when he started on a project, he wouldn't quit and all this, and I says, that's the guy we're going to make port commissioner out of. I told Federoff at the Chamber of Commerce. And so I went down to meet him for the first time, and I said, if you'll listen, I'll guide you into where you'll become elected, and I'll put the longshoremen behind you. I know, they know my program perfectly. And I says, they're for it. So all I will have to say is, Maury Raymond's the guy that's going to do it for us, and they'll back you. Then I says, I got confidence of the Central Labor Movement now. And although I didn't go up there till 1950, I guess it was. No, 47. I went there in 47. And so he became elected, and this was, we called it the Mutual Admiration Society here, Osgood and his three commissioners, and they just had a nice little clique going. This one guy had these inland boats, and he used the warehouse for his warehouse, and they didn't want any change. See, they didn't get together, and Osgood said, "You're not going to put that on my dock," and this kind of thing. Even in the Navy, even at the Navy blacktopped the dock and lighted. Finally lighted it, I guess. But he didn't want to do certain things. He says, "You're not going to do that on my dock." So this guy didn't want any growth. And then there was a thing going on uptown, the lumber barons. You must have heard of them about them by now. Tiny would have mentioned it for sure. The lumber barons, they come in here when there was virgin timber, and they made a mint. And then they hired their attorneys to keep this town. You know, they had some of the sharpest young men I met, who were generally always young, that I met as I went around these different boards. And they'd stymie it if they could, and they always reported back. And so it was awfully hard to break through. But we finally broke the log jam with this Raymond working here and me working through there. And we, and what I call the log jam, and we made our move. And then we finally got their entire board into the Central Labor Council, I mean into our own offices in our new union hall. And I was behind building that union hall. I was president in 1950. And so we got them into our offices there. It was Maury Raymond, of course, and Blair, who they finally named that bridge after, Blair Waterway. Later on they changed the name for him. And there was Erdahl. And they had a, oh my goodness, what was his name? He worked under Osgood all those years, and then he became their manager, but he, Woodruff. But he didn't have what it took, and we knew it. Erdahl, oh yeah, the three men, but that's all, just three guys. And Blair then is chairman, is what it was. So I sat across from him. Les Clemenson is the only one left here, and Schomer in Port Angeles are the only ones left that I ever negotiated with. See, I left in 62, you know, and left the docks in 62, a sick man, then bad sick. And we got them now. This is important. I'm battling to get an ore dock. I went to work first to get an ore dock, get the Sitka Waterway dredged. I pointed the dock where it should go. A few logs dumped, that's all. They could dump them somewhere else or put them in the flats and use bulls. Bulls were coming in. I'd heard about them anyway. And so now I'm not only going what I know, studying, meeting the maritime tradespeople in Seattle, mm-hmm. all the while, I belong to that, and reading and studying all these other ports and what they go through and all. So I'm demanding that we get an ore dock. And our trade was going on up the Columbia River and going by rails, and we're not getting it. And we were originally, and we got five railroad lines going out of here. And we also got our smelter over there. So making copper, aluminum, and they expanded greatly after they could get this thing done. So I was after them and listening to what they said. No new docks. One guy fell through and hurt himself clear up to here. Jitneys had dropped through and take a long time to get them out. And this kind of thing. And so we're after him to get a Nordock. And I heard Erdahl whisper to Blair while we were pressing him. The table wasn't much wider than this in our hall there, about this wide. And I heard it, see. He says, "He's talking about $1 million. And I says, "Mr. Chairman, I heard that." I says, "I sure am." I says, "It'll take you at least $1 million to do what we want now." And I says, "That's just a start." And their manager, he saw his chance. He's a fuzzy, funny, daddy kind of guy. He says, "Cox, you want the moon." I says, "We didn't ask for the moon, but I said, you deliver it, and we'll make use of it." And that shut him up. And so now I says, by now, I said, we're not asking anymore. You know why we called you in here? You're going to build that dock. I says, if you want to stay in your positions, you will build that dock. Now, we might as well break up for now, because we got a lot of ideas, and you know what they are. But we called you in here to tell you, not to ask you. I says, out there's Pierce County that's sold on this now. And if you don't, we're going to go to Pierce County and remove you. Well, just fast you come up, staggered deal. I says, we got the power to move you. So we showed him what we could do with another guy. He led against Blair, led in the primaries. He was old and he wasn't fit for the job. But that's the only one that lined up, and I couldn't. I couldn't. It was an area where I couldn't sign up anymore. They wanted me to go one more time. Well, finally, I then ran in 56. And at least I sold the program far and wide. I was making speeches all over the county. I come pretty close. But we started too late. And there, Mladenov helped. He's an unassuming prosecuting attorney. He's one of the right-hand men for him. He never fronts, but he's behind the scenes with a lot of things, and he's always given of his time. So he helped with us. And now, lift on, I'm preaching, lift on, lift off, roll on, roll off, and I says particularly lift on and lift off. And mechanization all the way through, I'm preaching it. And then they bought the shipyard just about that time. A very reasonable deal from the government.
The Navy, yeah.
And I had been there. I was one of the young men that they insisted that I go over. They were short of riggers, and the front wasn't moving fast. So I did. And I worked there a while, and just in the bull gang I started out, and I wanted on the birdies, and I let them know. And I says, and I can prove to you that I can do pretty good there. Had it more interesting, you know. Movement, see over the ship and down in the holes and everything. I was still vigorous yet. Playing ball around town even. And not big teams, you know. And so I'm soon now they're building the new outfitting dock along this side over here. They're building a big new one. And heavier crane, 75 ton safe lift. And I wanted to get on that, so I let it be known. And so they moved me over to there and gave me it said, pick your own crew. And I went. Well, first off, in the cars, I made a name for myself in the cars. They come in with every kind of a thing, all mixed up. And the guys would go out there and tear quite a lot of that up. Good longshoremen, too. Two of them were, and I embarrassed them, really. I hated to do it, but it's a judgment deal, how to move it out, how to sling it up. And you got to know where the center of gravity is with your mind and all. I could actually, to follow this through on the waterfronts. You come up with a log like this, you may have seen them. You gotta come up to get them up on the deck, you lay them down on the deck, you re-sling them. I can often just take one look up and down and put my sling where I wanted it and go on in with it, see. And I've seen the guy next to me, he's dead by now, Barney Rooker, the colored guy, six times maybe, you know, he would change his sling. And oftentimes I could do it the first time. And one of the young bucks growing up under me sights. It says, Floyd, watch me. When I got down there one day, he said, I can do the same thing you used to do. And I said, great. So anyway, that judgment. I pull this stuff out of the cars without tearing it all up, bending it all up. And they knew that. The cars began to move. I was sent over there special for that because the word got around. And so then I had this whirly crew, four of us, and we were on the outfitting dock. And then the big boss says, we're going to move. We're going to move all that stuff down here now. That's up there. The dock is finally finished. And we set up another crane, and we're going to move this stuff. Use our crane to set up one. They set up the next one. And so we're going to go to work down here now. He says, we're going to move in six and seven, one on each side of the dock, and they're going to outfit them. We're going to have, you guys are going to bust your prat, he says. And I said, good. We want to be busy. So we really would rather be busy. And so that's the way it turned out there. Now, they called me back to the docks when the lend lease came in. They requested. They don't say you have to. They requested I come back, and I did. And he said, we want you to go back and pick up a gang. Now, I'd never had a gang. I had driven winch. And I never replaced the event. Like I said, I'd wait till there was an opening. And finally, I was a winch driver for a gang, I think, when they called me over there. And so I came back and handled a gang. And I was soon into the heavy lift hatches. And they transferred me from one my gang from one ship to another. Now, it isn't all me. I knew who to get, see. I had a gang, baby. I had a bunch of men that I didn't have to tell them anything once I got down there. I would figure out for them from the deck, and I had such a, they had a confidence in me that the boss would say to the checkers and the, who's the guy ahead of a checker, one up from the checkers, not a supercargo or anything, supervisors, you tell a supervisor, don't come to me if Cox wants you to take this car out and get him another one out there. I go out and look around the yard and everything. It's a war, and I had pride, and I wanted to get the job done right, and I always took this pride. My dad said, I see you running to the docks. He says, if you're going to go down there, you're going to do your work right. He says, I'd rather have you 30 years of age and put your feet under my table than to go down there. He says, I got a reputation. I don't want you to ruin it. I said, you don't have to worry. So you see, I grew up that way. So, and now I got a brother and a nephew out there in the war, and later on another brother. And I believe in this. If you're going, I hate war, but if you're going to go to war, win it. That stupid Korea, Korea was bad enough, but Vietnam, that was stupid. I mean, the losses and the reputation we lost over the world, and I predicted that to us, as America's going to come out of there embarrassed to the world. And I got proof. There's still a friend of mine retired over on the peninsula that I told it to. So now, we get these waterways pumped out of here. We set aside 800 feet around. They start building warehouses. I says, build yourself some warehouses up there. I says, you're congested down here all the time. And build yourself a big dock. I was for this one. They never surpassed me until recent years. Even after I was gone from here for pretty near 10 years, they were still building according to the thoughts that I had had. And I didn't say where each dock should go other than that ore dock. But no more small stuff along the waterfront. Save so much back clear on around for the deep sea shipping. Because I was preaching, no seaport city is any greater than its ability to ship. And this is one of the things I used to tell all the time. And in the meantime now, the Port of Tacoma Planning Board has been established, and I'm Labor's only representative there for quite a while. The Marine Affairs Committee of the Central of the Chamber of Commerce, I'm on that for a lone member from the Central Labor Council for quite a while. And then others, Pete Peterson joined me, and he says, I'm coming out to learn, I want to know. And he had ambitions to be the Secretary Treasurer. So he would know all the way around. He's already a billing tradesman, see. He knew that. So now he's wanting to learn the Marine. And by now, the people are convinced this is the way to go. And I was telling how many, I had the figures on how much a ton of general cargo would bring to the city, and the sailors spend their money, supplies coming back, and all that. And then I was thrilled now as the outgrowth of this whole thing. As far as the industrial part is concerned here, to find out one thing while I was down south. I read in our little paper, the dispatcher comes to my house, and I'm up at Mariposa by this time, that 3 years in a row, this was the only port that excelled in three departments. Number of ships, tonnage going in and tonnage going out. The only part, a big port on the coast. Now this is a whole outgrowth of this whole thing. Now, when I started, I got a backup. See, I told you I'd miss, and I have a backup. I got a backup for some two key ones. I became the business agent in 47, and I immediately went to the Central Labor Council and said, I'd like to put my shoulder to the wheel, and I believe in unity of labor. I'd like to put my shoulder to the wheel for what it's worth, and help in the entire labor movement as a group. And they stood up and gave me a big hand. I understand that. I thought I made brief and brave, you know, but they had been hungry for the longshoremen. Even Tiny Thronson was one of them, and Miller, I'm sure he was one of them. They got in a beef up there years before and quit. And nobody had gone for years to Central. They didn't see it, didn't think they needed it. But I knew that they were going to have to pull together to get the things done I was dreaming of. And I knew that these old boys was going to have to get that sack off their hump. And the young ones, in fact, coming on, would not serve like that. They wouldn't back those loads. Now we'll take 46 behind that now. That was 47 I started there. And it wound up already that in the 50s, Morey Raymond got elected, you know, 52. Now in 46, one of the key things that happened here, we had a few crane operators and a darn few cranes. We didn't have a heavy lift over here on this side. And I'm committed to this in my mind. This is one of the things that has to come later. And so, but these guys had had these cranes since the time they were built. They run them. Now, I get elected to the Washington State Federation of Labor Convention for the first time, I think, about 46, I'm not positive of the year. And lo and behold, the big issue was over the cranes. The operating engineers in Seattle have the cranes. I don't know if they still do. On the docks. Mm. Everywhere they had them. So they were going to have the cranes here. And so Andy Larson didn't want it. Robert Collins, I don't know if he's still alive yet. Andy's dead. Robert Collins was the district secretary. He didn't want to take on these guys, powerful outfit. They're an outfit that entertained the whole delegation, 500 people. Come as you may, eat all you want. And they take care of the expenses and drinks too. And they do it every time we got there. See, that's big. And here we are, this little outfit that I face him for the first time and hold Jack McDonald off. He never liked me from then on. He acted like he did, but I know that every time he would never give me a chance when I was trying to get the maritime trades for him. So those are two important things right there. And we held the cranes. Now our guys operate all the cranes. Now when I start to run for port commissioner, this is backing up again, that's 56. I had a picture taken of me over there in the shipyard with all the booms laying down. And it said, time to boom up. I knew they owned them, and I wanted to see them coming out of these docks, see. And in the, backing up once more, in the meantime, in 47, I fought for that big, well, it's up here someplace, a low one. They got a special name for it. We got to have a name for that so everybody will understand. Anyway, I got a crane and the darn fought it through these committees and the Central Labor Council and all. And darn if they didn't stick it up on a short spur out on the end where a lot of ships couldn't tie up. They wouldn't tie up because too dangerous. Break the lines loose. Ship didn't have a chance to tie up out there right on an angle pier. Now, of course, we're way up here handling logs or something. And they said, and a friend of mine drove where I'm standing, drove cranes. He's retired last July. And he says, that's a dandy crane to this day. It's a good one for its purpose. And he was driving this one on the barge where they lift up the whole barge, loaded barge, and set it up. And by the way, you build a reputation as doing your work. We were called the Port of Uninterrupted Service. When Morey Raymond was in, they got a pamphlet, brochure out for the world. And we were termed the Port of Uninterrupted Service. And there was stoppages of work continually in some of these other ports. Seattle was bad. You see, we didn't want to join Seattle. I was of a group of guys who didn't want to join Seattle because they wouldn't take care of their trade. And this is a key thing I want to stay away from. But still, I wasn't satisfied with the ILA. It was racket-ridden. You could see pictures of guys with two or three matched stems in their hat, or four or five. That means they pay a dollar for each match to get that job. And then when you tried to fight back against the authorities, oh, you got knocked around, broken arms, just stepped up. And there's many a guy went out in the river or out in the water, salt water, with a concrete boot. and they held sway. So I started fighting them. I had more guts than sense when I was dedicated. I just went anyhow and just let one of those guys, you might say, you let the devil take the hindmost.
Mm-hmm.
One of those, that's one of the expressions for that kind of guy. And that determined guttiness is one of the reasons I'm alive today. I wouldn't quit when I could have quit and died in moments. I wouldn't. And I could come back and make it again and revive and oftentimes get out and hike around pretty good again and then get into it again. And so and we don't want to go into the health program yet. I want that all in one piece. So I'm battling the East Coast using the Maritime Trades to help me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm battling the East Coast knowing that while we build out here, this is one project. The other one is your union status. Did not want to belong to ILW. They wouldn't take care of the trade. And I don't want to go into personalities there. I don't want to go into any bitternesses and hate, although I had them. I left here and Pritner put me in my grave. Four hates and many bitternesses. And I finally gave them all up. I gave them all up, took Jesus into my heart, cleaned up the whole thing. I have none now. I don't see much of a point in me blasting those people. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do it. We're with them now. I get my pension from there. I'm not afraid of having my pension cut off over it. I'm not talking about that. But I'm just talking about what's to be gained. Nothing. But they still need to come up with this port right here, right now. You know why this port is really booming? Yeah. This port is really booming because the men produce. You see, these old timers produced. I don't know where they got there. This Tacoma group were workers. Mm-hmm. They'd take those 180-pound sacks, 150-pound sacks all day long and go like anything with them. You know, they kept moving. Pack lumber, they did their work. And so I said to, when I started negotiating, I says, you guys do your work. You know, you talk rough to the men. This is the biggest club you could give us, negotiators. I says, that's our biggest club we could have to whip the boss in the line. You know, you talk it tough. You didn't talk tough. Andy Larson told me, you're not elected because of what you know. He says, you got a blast. Kidding one another, you know, the biggest blaster gets the best job in the Picard deal. We called our own selves labor fakers and Picards. And we talked like this. So I could do that. I had the voice and my voice is one of Carrie's. The guy at the back can hear me just as well as the one in the front. And I don't even like Solomon's voice, but it's one that's heard. People hear me when I talk, in a restaurant or whatever. I'm heard when I don't want to be heard, when I think I'm whispering. I'll be heard in a crowd, in a motion theater or something. My voice carries. I've got one brother and one sister out of nine of us kids. They're pretty much the same way, and even my young daughter. So, I don't know where we were. One, these cars here, mm-hmm. Ed Turner met me in the Maritime Trades. I met with the Frisco, some of the Frisco representatives and like, and he was a new man, going to be a new man in the trade. And Linda Burke sent him to me to learn some of the ways to run a union, what you should do, the basics. And so I joined him here, right here. He came up here to see me. And we were together two or three days. This is background of what I'm going to tell you. Now, that friendship and knowing this port does their work, and these guys did keep me with that big club and the guys that were with me, but I was the chairman. And I could get things that the ILW couldn't get because of our workmanship. And then Turner says, I told the guy that unloads those cars to set himself up in Tacoma, that he won't have all those problems he's having. And that's what's out here today. I'm sure of it, because he told me this a couple years ago or something like that. So, and then, this is no accident that this is the only big port that excelled 3 years in a row. It's not an accident. They do their work. I don't know what they're like as union men, I mean, in their hearts. But they do follow through and get their job done. And the equipment is here, and these guys are highly skilled, these young men. And you see, I went into the employer, George Miller and I were the only two, he's dead, and we were the only two out of our whole group that were willing to bargain with the employer. Here's one of the keys. In 46, we were in there, I know. And we wanted to talk pension. Seems that the miners had gained something. And we both agreed, he and I, this is the time to hit him. Well, he started talking about pension and all, and I says, yeah, yeah, George. You know, everybody likes pie in the sky. You know what I told him? And they were laughing, and they had him blocked. I let him lead first. He was the oldest man, you know, and I always had this kind of respect that I told you before. I never liked crowd ahead of them unless they were failing in their job. Then I would take it. Unless if they wouldn't do the job. And I often carried old men on the docks, believe me, and do much more than what I would do if I had a good partner, just to keep them, get them the money, and keep, move along, you know, do much more work than what I would ordinarily. So here I am, I got that principle. It's part of my makeup, and I let him go ahead. They laughed him out of position, and I just put my hands up, like I said, I says, now wipe off the grin off your face, but when I get through, you won't be grinning. Now I says, I came to town when the wage I was 55, and I knew we had to do something to build that port back. I says, you are using the same old-fashioned gear that I saw in pictures when I was a kid. And I says, mechanization is coming upon the world and is coming around you, and you're going to be caught short. So I says, so you're going to want mechanization. I said, you know how you're going to get it? I says, the age average was 55 when I got there, in about 41. And now I says, these old boys are getting really old. And I says, you know who you're going to get to take their place? The union's so strong, we're going to give you sons and nephews and the like, to a great extent. And because they're the ones who are going to get the jobs, they're going to get the training, because we're going to see to it they do get the jobs. I says, that's the power in our union. We had our own hiring hall. See, we maintained that way longer than the ILW. We maintained our own hiring hall, finally gave it up, and paid for it, and run it. And so we tried to run it fair to the employer all the way around, give them good service. We were tough on our men when they failed, and we tried to keep them in line. So I said that, in order to get, you're too late now in getting started, really, but I says, you're going to have to do it. And these old boys won't fit. They don't want to drive. That's how I got to be a deck man. I says, they just said, Floyd, you go do it. Now, I says, they're going to die off. But we're protecting them now. I says, I just worked yesterday with Peters. I says, he's had every bone broken in his body. Every one of them, he says, at some time or other. Now, I says, he was my partner on lumber. And he held me back. And sometimes when I got on short stuff, I'd make up for packing extra loads and going faster and all. But I says, he held me back. Now, I says, I didn't tell him to get off the ship. I'm not going to do that. And we're not going to put him out along the road like some of the old horses I've seen either. We're going to take care of them. So I says, you know what you got to do? Give them pensions. Then you got to give them welfare. We got to have welfare too, because little Johnny down here now, that's about 6, 8 years old, you want a healthy product later on to run your equipment and all, and to take the place of uncle or dad or whatever. So we want him healthy. So we're going to drive for pension and welfare at the same time. And we will agree to you to help you with your mechanization. And you know, that's what we sold them that first. And we were first on pensions. I'm sure you can learn from Tiny or whoever. But we were ahead of the ILWU on pensions. In 51, we had ours underway. And I don't think they did till later. And we got several concessions. I don't think I can name all of them ahead of those, because we'd do their work. We'd do our work. And then I think that unless shut the thing down a minute, and I was teaching our people that we owe it to ourselves, to our city, to our county, to our state, and to our nation. And in fact, I says, shipping affects the lifeblood of the world. I says, no city's any greater than its ability to ship. And so, what do? You have to have, we have only one product. That is our labor. The employer has thousands of products. Mm-hmm. We have only one. It has to be the best. And we owe it to all these things that I've just named to have the best product that we can muster. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you go down there and kill yourself off, no. In fact, we're going to slow down some things where you guys were too hard on some things. But we're going to give you equipment to take the place of the onerous work that you do. But we still expect you to run that equipment right, mm-hmm. and serve your country. And anybody else that doesn't, we're not going to adhere to at all. And don't join them. Stay out of it. And keep in mind, guard this port of yours out here jealously. I say you're going to see that grow into a tremendous thing one day. I predict that right from the earliest. And I stayed with it after I'd been gripped by what I saw from up here. 2,000 acres were out there. We pumped sand into it while we made these waterways, and we were underway. And so, yes, and then I didn't know it at the time, but years later I realized why I had a solid block behind me. Every Christian, whether Catholic or Protestant, I just had them as a solid block because they did not want to go there. They thought it was communist dominated at that time. Now, by us living the way we did and doing our work the way we have and building our port the way we have, I am sure that we've helped modify the attitudes and the conduct of a lot of these other ports up and down this coast. Because once the people joined them and were a standout in our production here, then they could, the question is asked why? And they find out why. I think it's well known now that, and people change with the times. I know I was considered really radical at one time. And a few years later, when those same things got into practice, I wasn't radical anymore. And so by the same token, the ILWU modified its ways an awful lot. And change their ideas, and they do their work better, I'm sure, now than they used to. Mm-hmm. Well, of course they do. You've had quickies going on every day up and down the coast, someplace. One to a dozen on this coast at one time. And I didn't want to stop the ships. I wanted to keep them going. But I wanted our men to have what they're entitled to. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way I battled. And I battled the East Coast to become legitimate. We finally got Hasselgren, and what's the old guy's name that was there first? My gosh. Hasselgren was secretary and treasurer, the money man. Well, I never forgot, I never thought I'd forget the...
What, the international president?
Yeah, the longshoreman for years and years.
Ryan?
No.
Still? No.
Ryan?
Yeah, Joseph Ryan.
Yeah, Joseph. His name Ryan? Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, Joe Ryan. We finally got them both out here. And we've got them out here for one reason. We wanted them to become legitimate, so that, because we were going to have to find some place to light if they didn't. And I knew it. As time came on, I wasn't preaching this, but I knew that we were going to have to find some other place else to go. Because then they took on the East Coast, you know, radio, TV, and newspapers took them on. And there was a lot of advertising over there, misconduct. Then we went to IBL, International Brotherhood of Longshoremen, for a spell, rather than join the independent group on the coast. There again, I believed in staying in the AFL. I felt power, that's where your power was the backing that you could get. But I did go around with my hat in my hand to all the different organizations that I thought might assist us. And they didn't see fit to pick us up on a scale that would do us any good.
Uh-huh.
And so I knew before we were ever taken in that they would eventually, the ILWU would eventually get us. I knew it. But these men that had been with me all this time didn't want to give in anyhow. in other words, capitulate.
Yeah.
So we stayed with it until they took it away. And that's the whole of the story. I might have been able to join them for better concessions if I led the people into their place, mm-hmm. but I didn't look at that side either. I just stayed with the men and guided them the best I could till we were defeated. And there were a lot of votes, quite a few, before we finally suffered defeat.
Yeah, I've been through all the minutes and all the different times that it came up.
And then I was disheartened, and I had received an injury in my athletics, tore ligaments around my Broncos. And I'm back to the docks now, weakened from sitting on a seat, you know, mm-hmm. in an office. Body's never going to be the same again. And when you do it when you're that old, you don't build back. You get strong and in good shape again, but I claim when you're up in your 50s or 60s and you sit 2 or 3 years in an office, that it takes something out of you. And so back to the docks with a gang, and we've got the contest on, you know, to change the loading limits and all this kind of thing. Oh, actually, it should be a matter of a record. I went to Seattle with my gang for the first time, and I had a good gang. There were lumber of about a foot square, and they had each foot square wrapped, particularly wrapped, thick, heavy paper and banded. Nice looking bundle. Now they had three on the load across the top and three deep. And this stuff is so dry that I know a longshoreman, I'm sure, that could just get one up shoulder high, get under it and carry it over and throw it down. One of these bundles now. Mm-hmm. So this was a C3 and a brand new one. And 3/4 inch fall lines. And this thing would lift 7 ton like it was a bale of hay, you know. Just as easy as a bale of hay. It'd lift more than that. Safely, if you're boomed well up. Big boom. Big ship, fine new gear, all tested that, so, you know, before it comes to us. I put the hook down on the dock, and I always keep it above the men's heads so they can't get bumped. And I got one of the best winch drivers on this coast. I put him up against anybody, Connie Yates at the time. Quick and accurate. And so I have no fear of bringing him down close and stopping him off. He's always watching me, not asleep at any time. I don't remember him ever making a mistake of that kind. And so I stopped her off just above the headways. And I went back to answer somebody's call at me. And my men were way down deep. And I went back out to the rail, and there my slingup men, two old timers, fine old boys, worked for many, many years. And I'd asked always the older guys to work on the dock for me. Never did have a young man on the dock. And so I go out there, and they got one of these packages in the sling. And mind you, I've got these great big rope slings, you know, and brand new slings and everything, ready for a start here. And they got one of those wrapped up in that thing. You could hardly get it on the hooked up so little, you know. And I thought it was a joke. I said, you know, I swore like everything in those days. I won't even repeat it here. I swore all the time. I mean, I always thought the longshoremen wouldn't understand unless you did, you know. And probably so. At any rate, if they thought you were a sissified kind of guy, a lot of guys wouldn't work for you. Mm-hmm. Well, so I filled the bill in the boozing and the language. But I always I planned on doing my work and doing it right. But I mean, if somebody wanted to have a little snort or something, that's sort of fine with me. I'd join it. And I says, now, what is this? Well, they said, the bull driver says one package. There's one package in this port. That's all you take. Well, I says, that represents a package there, those nine of those. And that's a small package, I says. That's a very, very light load. And they said, well, the rule here is one package, no matter what the size. Well, I says, you better tell that bull driver to come and talk to me, guys. I says, I'm not lifting that. And they says, well, he's not here at the moment. So I went back to the hatch, and I don't mind it being a matter of record. I says, fellas, I'm not stupid enough to tell you that I'm going to quit and I want you to quit with me. I says, I wouldn't think of that. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. They got a package out there that I know a couple of you guys down here. Two of you could pack it with ease, and I know two or three of you down there could pack one by yourself. And I says, there's nine. You've seen these bundles, I says, the sling load of this wrap stuff. Yes, they all had. Well, I said, they've got one of those packages on the hook, and I won't hoist it. If they tell me I got to hoist it or get fired or quit, I'll do either. I'll quit or get fired. Doesn't matter. But I'm not hoisting it. And they says, you just come back and tell us the results. And when you get ready to leave ship, you just come over and tell us that you're going to leave. That's all you got to do. We'll be right behind you. And so it was a long time. And the bull driver, I said, get the business agent, you know. And I went to talk to the business agent. And finally they come out, the bull driver says, you can wrap up the load. Well, they slowed us way down. And then one time with lumber, I gets a tier in and call for dunnage. And they bring a little bit out, and I need much, much more. So I call for another big load of dunnage. And it was 45 minutes or an hour bringing it to me. This was to slow the gang down. So you see, they were that much slower in their port than our workmen were. And I had a gang that I would slow down myself. I would just shut off the winches and go get a coffee and things like that. Slow them down so they wouldn't get too far ahead. I didn't want them too far ahead. We weren't out there to set the world on fire. We were just out there doing our work right. Mm-hmm. And we insisted on doing our work right or not working. My whole gang, rather than sit down there with one package at a time coming in, they'd rather go home. There are men like that. And this is the answer for America today. For the workmen to do their work, you must do your work. You got to be honorable. You got to be worthy of your hire. And it's the answer for one of the key answers for America today, for every workman to take pride and interest in his work and do it right. Turn out a good product. We only have one, our workmanship. That's our product. So we went to the IBL a while, and I knew that wasn't going to work. We went back for convention. They weren't interested in what the West Coast had, and we were so far ahead of them in conditions and knowing how to do our work and even knowing how to run a union, and they weren't interested in us. I sat on them. On the main committees, and they care less whether I talked or not. So I knew that that was mostly grain handlers and this kind of thing in Chicago. It was headquarters. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where we met in Chicago. And I guess the headquarters was on the river.
St. Louis.
Yeah, St. Louis, Missouri. It was headquarters. And so these guys out here laughed at that kind of thing. That made us worse off, I think, going to IBL. But it was one way to stay in the AFL for a time. And then I knew that we were through. It was just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to announce it openly. The boys didn't. I called in a few of my close friends, and had a regular little executive board of my own, you know. So I met with them, put it up to them. They says, no, we're not going to walk into it. They got to take us. So that's the history there, the labor deal there. And my friend ran me around through this port, and it surpassed my thinking now. Didn't for a long time. Mm-hmm. I was up here in the 70s, and it had not.
Well, now, in 1955, there was that five-year plan that the commission adopted that was done by an engineering firm in New York, Tibbetts and McCarthy and something.
I remember the names.
Was that the... Did that incorporate most of what your ideas had been? Because that talked about, you know, dredging out the Hyla Bosa
What's
now the Blair, and putting in the turning basins and
now
the Sitkim and all that stuff.
It took me a little while to catch up with that. We sat on the Port of Tacoma Planning Board for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I was after much, much more than sometimes the planning board was willing to put in. No, they followed closely on the waterways and the types of docks and the distance from the waterways. Mm-hmm. And I pretty well had my own way until I wanted, as part of it, a road, as I told you before, across the end. To
where Lincoln is now? Or?
On up above all of these waterways. A main road going in and shoot right on through a fast road, see? Above all small shipping and everything, right on in to Tacoma and spread her out through Tacoma along with the freeway. And they couldn't see it. And I had to drop that off in order, that was one of the last things that they wouldn't concede to. I had to turn that loose and forget it. I could have put in a minority report, didn't see fit to do it, and just let it go. But otherwise, I got most things. Now, you can find out what year we were working on the freeway deal. Mm-hmm. And I was sent from the Central Labor Council again, longshoreman to the Central Labor Council. The Central Labor Council sent me out on all highways and bridges, along with everything marine, as I told you before. Now I'm on to this because they're talking freeway now. They're going to plan a freeway. And I'm down to Olympia, meeting with them, and they're talking about a four-lane deal through Tacoma. And I said, oh no, six is the very minimum. Three lanes on each side is the very minimum with their off-ramps in addition. Because I said, if you don't, as the city grows and as the industrial area grows, and that industrial area is going to grow, I says, one day, we're going to make that a superport, I told him then. And I says, one day you're going to find, instead of making a freeway, if you don't have enough lanes and enough on and off ramps, you'll find that instead of a freeway, you build a Chinese wall. And the very next day, Rosalie was over at Yakima to use those words. And so this was one of the things we battled to get the extra lane. Now, I was telling Blair, who is chairman of this Port of Tacoma, that you're going to build a road, this one, on out to the freeway. Now, I says, I know more about this than you may think, because I'm sitting on those committees for the Central Labor Council. And you've got no plan for a road to go out and join the freeway. Mm-hmm. And I says, that's vital, it's a must. And finally, I went into his office, and he threw up his hands like this. Time had gone by, and I'm battling. And he was an attorney, and no doubt a darn good one, but represented mostly big business, you know. And he threw up his hands, and he says, Floyd, don't say a thing, let me talk. I said, okay. He says, you're gonna get your road. It was agreed on today. And he says, what we gotta do is show that we are constructing that road. They went right out across the muck and the flats with gravel that they hauled from the hill over here somewhere, put on a great fleet of trucks, and they built that thing on out there. Mm-hmm. And today, man, it's something. I mean, the cargo that moves in over there, on one light, I saw...
Oh, no, I have to drive through that intersection all the time, so...
On one light, I saw three or four were coming down at the exact right time. And they hit the light just as it turned green, and they shot through. Before it was over with, I think it was 12 or 13 all told, but two of them had to stop. That would have made maybe 13. Two had to stop. They were flatbeds heading out, and they didn't get through the light. That many went through the light, coming and going. Loads going out, loads coming in. And empty trucks, which you know have come down here to unload, mm-hmm. which is, in my idea, the same. It's all cargo, what I mean, cargo. And that's how important that road is. And it became important immediately. And if they hadn't have done it, then you don't get it later. You have
that
to
set
That
also keeps
up.
All that traffic away from this more developed area in downtown, so you don't have the trucks having to go near downtown.
That is right. So I was one that could see ahead, and I saw that one way ahead. They didn't want to build that at all. I thought it was silly to begin with. And I said, no, it's a must. It's an absolute must. And so we've got a port here. I'm more proud to see what they've got here. And this is millions of money, dollars, to this county means millions. And now I leave at 62, and I wasn't the guy that went front. Ed Garrison wanted to write a story of my maritime life, and I told him no. And then I retired, and I got to breathing pretty good. I retired with infancy when I was 62, and I got both pensions. And the doc said, in fact, if I didn't get out of town, he told my wife, if you want him, get him out of the town. He may not live through 63. I don't expect him to. And so we went way over in Casey's Inlet, where Dad, we inherited the strip of land and some beach on the main bay, Casey's Inlet. Mm-hmm. Beautiful place for me, with no smoke at any time. The fresh air is coming from the southwest, mostly, and fresh air. And so I did improve. And then I get back downtown for some things. But I wouldn't help Maury Raymond with his new campaign when he finally shifted to wanting to run for treasurer. And he was here from 52 to 57, 60s. Well,
I've got it somewhere.
I got a note on that. Anyway, that's on one of these things. It's written somewhere. Oh, it's written in one of these up here somewhere, right near the... No, not on that one, on this one. I'll tell you. It's on this slip over here. 52 through 67, Maury Raymond was here. Then he ran for treasurer, and he's retiring in January. Mm-hmm. So while he was here, he did do a yeoman service in developing this, these things that we're talking about. And so, then I leave at 62 with my health. Mm-hmm. And by 70, I was in real tough shape again and pulled out of this country altogether. But a lot of these people hadn't seen me in 18 years. And so, even so, when I came to town in the early 60s, Garrison tried to write a story on me, and I was healthy enough going through with it. And I told him no. I didn't care to have my name bandied around at all. And so this is the first time like this. And I do this because the port is a beautiful thing and the men are doing their work. Mm-hmm. And another key reason, I had hopes of telling them why in this, I insisted on you including this.
Well, see, I can't make any guarantees that will go in the book.
Well, then I'll make a statement now, and maybe you naturally will probably cut that. That when I left here in 70, I couldn't even drive my own car. I left from the bay over there. I hardly ever got to town for those last few years at all. And I had to sit in a chair 3 months at a time, two winters in a row, 69 and 70. Now in the 69, 70 winter and 68, 69 winter. Now I recovered in the summertime when it got hot and I could get in the sun. I would get better and get around, at least enjoy myself. I had a nice 18-foot boat and loved to fish. And then I could hike some up in the woods. I had a big place, 120 acres. Sold my Waller Road farm and bought 120 acres all told. And so I had to leave it all. And in walking away, I lost plenty. But I had to get out of here for a couple of reasons. And I couldn't drive my own car. Well, along the shoreman, I got his son come back from the service, and I got him to drive us down. My daughter was 16. And we took off and went down to another daughter's, who was in her 40s, early 40s at that time. And so we lived there, and I recovered considerably, but then at 75 I'm dying altogether. This is all over now. I can't use medicines. Oxygen wouldn't work. Isopropyl. These sprays that you expand your bronchioles with, these atomizer sprays. Every time I'd use anything like that, I'd just tighten down the worse. And the pills didn't seem to help. I got to where I was immune to them, pretty well immune to them. And so I was going to die. And I went to a healing service and got an absolute perfect healing for my lungs. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't praise and worship, and I lost some of it. And then I worked to get it back, and it improved to where I am today. and I do quite well. But in the meantime, the Modesto doctor in 71 said I was waking up steadily at night for 2 or 3 hours. Sometimes my arm would have been paralyzed 2 weeks at a time, hanging at my side, and oftentimes numb all through here, and my elbow just a stinging and hurting back here, wake me up. My head would ache and at the base and all from this. He said I'd have to weld two vertebrae. It's all in here. And I said, well, I don't want to do that if I don't have to. But anyway, I found a chiropractor could help some, but it never would go away because they showed the x-rays, the spurs and the decay and more. Prednisone softens and it eats away at those cartilages. I'm just about 4 inches shorter than what I was. All the boys when I met them here, I wouldn't go to these meetings. I stayed away altogether. And finally they talked me to go on this time. And I went to the old timers meeting. I didn't stay for the meeting, but I was there for an hour and a half ahead of it and talked to the guys as they came in. And I was amazed at how they greeted me. That's why I was willing to do this. But I said on one stipulation I get to tell that I went to Jesus. And I said, I was a Christian kid, and I felt the Spirit strong in my body, and I know what it is. So I want to clean up my life now and renew that. Forgive me of my sins. Come into my heart and be the Lord of my life. And then I went to these healing services, and I got healing for my between my shoulders and in my back that I got hurt here when I was throwing copper when I was... a Liberty representative went down. So I slept at least 7 hours last night, right straight through. And I sleep my 6 to 8 hours. And if I wake up and got something on my mind, I get up anyway as my makeup. And so it's enough to carry me for that day. Then once in a while, nap in the afternoon. When I'm down to my home, I take a nap most every afternoon.
You I would too if I was home every day.
And then take a little nap. It makes your day, breaks your day, and then you wake up and have more pep. So I was district secretary in 56 into, I was their district secretary when they voted the GWILW. That's canceled me from 3 jobs in my local union, and stemming out of my local union, and 7 at the Central Labor Council. I was on the all the boards pretty near. Me and one other guy had the same kind of job. We were foolish. You need to be at home with your wife more than that and your family, and when you get that many jobs, you're not doing something right. I mean, you're carrying on too much. So they offered them to us, wanted us to take them, and we did. It was foolish. Should never have done it. If I ever had to go back, I would not. But that's how busy I was. And they voted me out. Then I worked the docks. I worked the docks 57 on into June. January 57, they form a gang around me again. And I go to the docks till June of 62. That's my last job. The 10th of the month, and I pulled out for it. Then I didn't show around the union hall or stay away from the docks. I come to the dock one time and need to see my brother, and I was the only one I can remember coming down to the docks to a ship in 16 years, we'll say, just about. You know, and I finally went back to the hall, and early morning at dispatch, I saw a few of the guys, especially these young ones, and you know, they knew me. So two or three of them said, you don't know me, do you? I said, I'm sorry, I don't. They said, well, they told me who their uncle was or their dad was. They says, we were only six, seven years old when we saw you last. And you, that's why you didn't remember us. Well, we knew about you because our dad and our uncle told us. You see, I was continually on some kind of a program. I wanted the better conditions. I was considered a true union man. They didn't have any doubt about that, see. And when I, and on the other hand, this helped me. The employer knew when I told them something, I meant it. And if they said, will you go home and tell this to your people, Oh, these guys around me would say, oh, yeah, yeah, sure, heck yes. But they didn't. But I would, if I promised, I did it. Mm-hmm. I kept the flow, and I had there, by that, when I got to be district secretary, I finally got to where I first started out, I wouldn't let a man buy me a cup of coffee in Port Angeles, not even a cup of coffee. One time I found a T-bone steak in front of me when I went back to Voice, and was gone a little bit, came back, a T-bone steak was there, and I got right up and walked away. When the waitress sat it down, I says, who's that for? She says, for you. And I says, so long. And it was all paid for. I says, who is paid for? She says, yeah. I says, see you later. Then I came up here. I wouldn't let the employer even buy me a drink or anything. But I got over that because I had established myself, and the guys knew I wasn't for sale. Mm-hmm. And others learned that I wasn't for sale. And so I was up in their headquarters and their secret places, and down three decks into just some darn fine dinners and all. And when they shelled out the cigars at negotiations and the like, I picked out one of those, what was 60 or 80 cent cigars in those days when you could buy a pack for a quart. I would take it on, you betcha, because I had proven already I was not for sale to anybody. And so I left with a clear conscience. I just said, they'd accuse me by this time when, you know, when the program got on the tapes. They says, a lot of new men came on the docks, lots of them that I had never seen before. You know, they're moving in there. And I didn't know who they were. I'm in the office and they're getting their B's and then a permit, and then they're even getting into the A group. So they accused me of having my armpit deep down in their pockets, and this is all part of the program to take us, you know, this guy. Yeah. I could stand anything, any kind of a fight, but they found my weakness. If they lied about me, I'd blow them a cork. Isn't that something? Knowing that they're going to lie about me, but they never did it before. They fought me on issues. They had enough respect for me. My enemies in the ILWU, no matter where they were on this coast, you could find out if they weren't telling the truth. They had a respect.
Excuse me,
for you.
Just a minute. How about that?
So I went back through my notes here, and I covered most all of it.
Well, I think you covered most of the stuff that I was interested in. I can't think of any other questions except one other thing. Do you know what happened with the files and the records for District 38 when after you were district
secretary?
When
they wound up?
Yeah.
They were kept in a warehouse for a while, storage, and they disappeared. And I don't think ever to be seen again.
Was it a private warehouse? Is that where there was just was rented space?
They were in both places for a while. Uh-huh. I mean, they had been in each kind of a place, and then disappeared altogether. I don't think they'll ever be seen again.
Yeah, because that's one of the things we were hoping we might be able to track down. But
they'd been looted so many times anyway.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. That I'm sure that anything the ILWU didn't want in that outfit wasn't in there anymore. By the time I got in the office in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the office girls says their stuff went out of there. She was a friend of mine. She liked me. And she said, did you know that stuff had been going out of there daily before you came? And there's been studies made. Yes, we broke the log jam here, and I told you about they had a mutual admiration society here. Men were falling through holes in the docks and jitney. One of the guys coming off the ship same time I did fell in up to his hip, and he was a guy who weighed well over 200 pounds, and boy, he got hurt. It was, fell in a hole, there was no lights there. So we battled our way up, you know, to conditions and safety. And there's only one other thing I was getting on, and yes, it can be proven, so I'll state it. It was, we were continually working with the employer trying to get a safety code drafted. Mm-hmm. And the ILWU seemed to be on the same thing. And we would meet in three or four from the employers and three or four from our side on these safety things continually. And we could never get it spelled out. I accused them of this. I said, you employers don't want a safety code spelled out because tonnage is your profit. You're working the profit angle all the time. And I says, myself, I want to see you make money, because I've told the men, it's been my belief, when you make money, we're going to get more for ourselves. We stay strong, we're going to improve as the industry improves. Mm-hmm. But I says, in this case, we've got to have welfare spelled out to where it can't be touched by the employer, it can't be touched by the men. It has to be spelled out. And it'll have to go to law to get that out of the fellow. So now, finally, Andy Larson was sick. He had a bad stomach at the last. He was sick, and I can't name the exact year. All this time I've been talking, I've been trying to think of the exact year. But I was working. So it must have been either prior to 54 or a little after that, or a little after 62. No, I left bad sick, so it had to be prior to me going in the office. About 1950, maybe. That's my best guess. Mm-hmm. And Andy, right near there, Andy come to me and said, the governor is calling for a safety conference and has called the hall and wants a representative. He says, I can't go for it, I'm too sick. You go. He says, I'll send a guy down to the dock now and you go home and rest and think about this. And you be there. So I went home, and I like to bathe, not bathtub, and plan. So I took myself a hot bath and planned it. Got up in the morning and wrote it out, took it down to a girl and had it typed out, and went down to the conference. And the ingredients in that thing, and I was up in front of the ILWU guys, I first got them together. Yes, I did.